Welcome to the ASCD podcast, supporting you on your journey as a life-changing educator. Here's your host for today's program.
Hi, everyone. I'm Anthony Rabora, the Chief Content Officer for ISTE ASCD. Data has become a central part of school and district instructional systems. But are there ways schools can use data so that it's more hopeful and supportive rather than punitive? Can they move beyond just test scores to using more holistic observational data to see students' experiences more clearly and help teachers improve in the finer points of their practice? My guests today believe they can. I'm joined by Jim Knight and Michael Fajella-Luby, who are experts in instructional coaching and cognitive learning strategies. They are also the authors of the important new book, Data Rules, Elevating Teaching with Objective Reflection, which seeks to reframe the conversation on data in learning. So welcome, Jim and Michael, and congrats on the book. It's great.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
So data has been a big topic in K-12 education for many years. The term data-driven instruction, for example, became commonplace during the No Child Left Behind era, I believe. What distinguishes your approach to data use in teaching and learning from what educators might already be familiar with?
So Michael and I are going to do a little rock, paper, scissors to see who gets the codes first on each of these things. But I think I'm taking this question. So the book Data Rules is kind of a pun, and it's rules like here are the rules to follow, but also rules like, you know, Led Zeppelin rules. Led Zeppelin's a band from a few years ago. Most people might not remember. But anyway,
I recall.
Well, it rules. And so the rules that make this unique, I don't know exactly how different schools use data in all their different ways, but we would say data should be a positive thing. It should foster hope in ways we might talk more about. It should be grounded in professional development. So it should be something that leads to coaching or other forms of professional development. It should be iterative. It should be gathered weekly. It should be easy to gather, gathered by teachers, chosen by teachers. And sometimes data seems something that's imposed on others, and it takes away hope because I'll just give you an example of one time I was in a school district, and all the teachers were there, the administrators were there in this big room, and the person in charge of data shared the data. And then he said, well, his intent was good, but he said, people, we have to do better. Our students deserve more. We should do more. And I think every teacher who was sitting there is like, if I knew how to do more, I would do more. And so the data was demoralizing, not building hope. But we would say data should help you set goals and then be tied to professional development that helps you hit the goals, build pathways towards goals. And so when it's iterative, frequently being gathered, then it's really a lot more helpful.
I see. Yeah, you do caution that, I'm quoting, used incorrectly, data can keep us from seeing what is most important all around us. Is there an example of that that you think is fairly common in schools of that kind of misuse of data?
Yeah, sure. Great question. You know, I think probably most teachers would be familiar with maybe the use and misuse of standardized assessments to determine things like teacher quality. You know, it happens all the time that we try and use data validated for one purpose, but instead that metric becomes something used to measure something completely else. That's not what the purpose of that measure was. Frequently, you'll see things like schools using benchmark assessments like fall and winter and spring assessments that they're helpful, but then we try and use them to figure out rate of student growth and level of response to instruction. Things that teachers need to make decisions don't come from that data on a daily basis. We want to think about data that's used more for kind of two distinct purposes, right? We're thinking about, yes, student learning. And we have a lot of chapters in the book getting at student achievement, thinking about student learning outcomes. But there's also this wonderful opportunity to use data correctly in the sense of how does it empower us as teachers to know whether or not the instructional decisions that we've made match the student learning needs that we've designed our instruction for. And that's when I think it's being used most correctly. The other thing that we sometimes see, unfortunately, is data is data. It's not good or bad data. But what can happen is that it gets reported vertically, right? We have teachers spend a lot of energy collecting that data, and then they pass it up the chain, and nothing ever comes down. It's not used to improve outcomes for kids. And I think we really want to move beyond that. We want to empower teachers to be able to look at data for themselves so that they knew these are the practices with the kids I'm engaging with every day. And in light of that data that I'm collecting, really help improve my regular everyday practice.
One of the things you stress that's interesting is use of video as a form of data gathering. And I know video has been a big part of Jim's work, but I don't think educators often think of it in connection with data. Can you explain why it's so key to your approach to collecting data?
I think this one's mine. And I'll give you a little story to illustrate it. So I had a friend of mine, she was a journalist, and she was staying with us when I lived in Canada, in Toronto. And I forget what her topic was she was researching. She lived from Montreal, but she came to Toronto. And so she's going to go all over the city to do all these interviews. And so she came back after spending the day doing these interviews. And I said, so what did you learn? I mean, what did you get out of the interviews? And she said, I learned a lot about shoes. I said, what do you mean shoes? Well, her shoes were really tight. They really hurt her feet and she had to walk everywhere. And so they were pinching her feet and they were sore. And then she was sitting on the subway and looking at other people's shoes. Her eyes were focused on that. So she came back and rattled off like 10 or 15 different things. People don't polish their shoes or something, on and on and on, because her brain was zoned in on that. And that's how perception works. You know, it's the experience sometimes you have when you get a car that's new to you and you're driving around in the car and suddenly everybody else has exactly the same car as you. It's not like overnight there was a big buying of cars. It's your perception is shaped by that thing that you bring to it. And that's why I think perception works. We see what we focus our attention on. When I wrote the book, Focus on Teaching, my teachers told me that they had to have something to guide their attention. So they looked at more things. If they just watched the video, they would only see certain things. So that got us started on, well, what are the things you need to look at? And we identified a number of little sort of like interpretive windows to shape the perceptions of people. If you start to look for ratio of interaction or how many kids are engaged, or it doesn't even have to be necessarily video, to other kinds of data as well, but they're going to help you see things you wouldn't ordinarily see. And even if you look at the video, you'll miss stuff unless you have some kind of heuristic tool, some kind of rule of thumb to shape your perceptions. And that's the power of data with respect to video. So the other thing I'd say is video is really important because we don't see our perception clearly. It doesn't matter who we are. It's not just teachers, artists, whomever, performers. We don't know what reality looks like. We don't see it clearly because of confirmation bias or other kinds of perceptual errors, because of defense mechanisms like explaining away the problem, or because we want to have certainty. And so when you combine data with video, you get a clearer picture of reality. You see things you wouldn't ordinarily see. It's not uncommon for a teacher to watch a video of his class and then after watching the video go, wow, that's got to change, and be motivated to change all of a sudden, like overnight, because they saw things for the first time. And there's a book called Useful Delusions that says these things that protect our psyche are actually helpful, defense mechanisms and so forth. If we saw life in its naked brutality, it would probably be too much if we saw it clearly all the time. Those defense mechanisms sort of protect our psyche. But if we want to learn, we have to get around those and see what's really happening.
So you mentioned, Michael, did you have another?
I was just going to add that, you know, I think one of the things that when you're writing a book like this, the word data can be used to define a lot of different things. And one of the decisions we made early on in the process that Jim is describing is that because we had both worked with video, because we felt like it helped us get past some of the bias, or just, you know, as a teacher, you're doing so many different things during a lesson. It's hard to pay attention and reflect on something that just comes from memory. So we made some decisions about the kinds of data we wanted to encourage teachers to collect and really lean towards objective data, things that like the video would be able to reflect back to us, maybe what's working and what's not, so that it was a little more objective in the process. And we had to make some decisions early on about we couldn't include everything. So we really wanted to give teachers variables they could look at that were sort of black and white, like teacher talk versus student talk, so that we knew the students' rates of opportunities to respond, because that's what meant engagement during the lesson. And then I'd have a better sense of how time was spent while I was engaged in the process.
Great. That leads right to my next question. Are there particular kinds of data that you think schools should be collecting on student learning that they aren't right now commonly? I'm wondering, like, are there money ball data points that educators may be overlooking right now?
I don't know that there's like a certain set of, these are the things every school should gather.
Okay.
Well, there may be, and Michael could probably speak to it better because he's more the researcher here than I am when it comes to all this material. There may be certain things that are absolutely crucial. But what we would say is the whole process is driven by looking at students and setting a goal. Well, traditional forms of professional development, a researcher talks to a consultant, the consultant talks to the teacher tries to change what they're doing to focus on the students. But we say, let's start with the students and have the teacher identify a goal, go to a coach who understands the research. Everything we do, we put kids first in the process. And in order to see what's happening with the kids, to make the invisible visible, as many people have said, we need data. So we look at things related to engagement, achievement, and teaching practice. That's really what the focus of the book is. But engagement could be broken down into the behavior of students. It could be, are the kids actually getting out of the activity what they're supposed to get out of it, what's called cognitive engagement? Or it could be, do the kids feel safe in class? Do they have hope? Do they feel like they belong in school? Do they have positive experiences and friends, what people call emotional engagement? And then with achievement, I'm not going to get into all the details, but we have the same kind of precision in terms of breaking down. Are we looking at acquisition of knowledge, transfer of knowledge? What kind of level of depth are we looking at? And we look at a number of different ways of gathering that data through the use of things like rubrics or selected response or multiple choice. So along the way, we've got tools for explaining all these things. If you want my opinion, though, I don't know if you do or not, but I'm going to go with that.
Sure, sure.
So my opinion would be, it's really important to see how many kids are engaged in the lesson. It's really important to understand if the kids feel like they belong, they feel safe, that they feel emotionally engaged. I think a lot of people ignore those two things because they don't think engagement is that important. But when you look at the research, the main reason kids drop out is lack of engagement. And then if I was going to look at a third thing that maybe doesn't get looked at, it's instructional time, or what we call productive and unproductive time. I tried to call it wasted time, but everybody who read the book said, no, it's got to be called productive and unproductive. And wasted time is too negative. But you could have 30% of a class or more be unproductive time. And so if you just increase the number of kids who are engaged and how productive the time is, you should have a lot more learning taking place. And when I work with a school where they focused on productive time, a school in Lincoln, Nebraska, they shrunk unproductive time from 22% to 4%. And their scores went up by about 18%. It was almost exactly lined up. And they went from being a really struggling school to a really successful school because they looked at how time was being used in the classroom. Every teacher was conscious of the fact of how much time is being unproductive.
And I would add too that some of my favorite sections of the book, you've got to write a book with chapters and sort of focusing on isolated skills, but Jim's idea here of engagement is the interplay between these variables, right? So I was in a school recently where the teacher was talking about how much she liked being the third grade teacher at this school. And it was hard because what she described was, what she liked was, she could lecture for 45 straight minutes without any of the students interrupting her. And I thought, there's something else about engagement here that's completely missing. And in fact, what happens sometimes is when a teacher tries to lecture for 45 minutes, the students are going to interrupt, right? They become these behavior problems. But in effect, what I loved were our chapters where we looked at engagement around this opportunities to respond, right? The Council for Exceptional Children recommends 4 to 6 opportunities for students to respond per minute. Well, I've been taking this out with undergraduate students, graduate students, out with schools, and really just objectively looking at, in a given period of time that you've been working with kids, how many questions did you ask? How many different ways did you give them an opportunity to engage? I mean, any of us as adult learners who've sat through a long meeting where you didn't get to say anything, we know that squirrely feeling. But now if you're 8 or 10 or you have ADHD, it's so much harder to sit there. So let's get them involved. And the book really points out some quick and easy ways that you can do that and see a change over time so that we can get to exactly what Jim's talking about, which is reducing that transition time or off-task time or wasted time and be able to get us to the learning we really want to engage students in.
And I should mention, the book does include some forms that break down the types of data collection that are really helpful. So this goes way beyond, you know, spreadsheets and looking at test score data. Where should a school leader start in setting up a system to collect and use data better on teaching and learning? What's the first step you would recommend, or first steps?
I would say the first place to start is to connect it with professional development. That is, telling people, here's some data on your classroom, fix it, is not really going to build hope, and it's not going to build change. I like the literature on hope. I mentioned before that hope is, I have something I'm hoping for, I can see a pathway to that goal, and I believe that pathway will take me there. The researchers at University of Kansas, Rick Snyder and Shane Lopez, have written about this. And so data helps you see what's happening so you can set a goal, and data helps build agency by showing progress towards the goal. So I think data without a playbook of practices to help you hit the goal isn't that helpful. It doesn't do me much good to tell me, here's what you weigh, you're on your own. It'd be great to have somebody help me figure out how to work on that, do whatever I want to do. So I think it has to be tied to professional development. And in my case, I would say it probably needs to be tied to instructional coaching, something like that. But specifically, I think you want to start thinking about, well, what are the kinds of things that we want to see happening in our classrooms? Instead of saying, what's not happening, say, what would it look like? And then how can we measure those kind of things? I take a solution-focused approach. And in the book, we've got, I don't know how many different data points, maybe 20 different data points in terms of things we would look at related to achievement or engagement. And so to look through those elements of data, those kinds of data we're looking for and saying, which one of these are most important would be the way I'd be a starting point to say, this is exactly what we want to see happening. And then I would say one other part that is important and useful is to build a shared vocabulary around different things. So when people start to talk about ratio of interaction or time on task or emotional engagement, experience sampling, close watch, they know what those assessment methods are, and they know what they're being used to measure. And once you've got that shared vocabulary, you can have a much deeper conversation about what's really happening. Well, when you say engagement, do you mean time on task, or do you mean emotional engagement, or do you mean cognitive engagement? And how would we measure that? Did you try experience sampling? That's a lot richer than just saying, well, my kids aren't very engaged. So I think building that shared vocabulary, I don't want it to be data by itself. It should be data tied to professional. It should be giving people a pathway to the goal that the data helps them set, is the way I would put it.
Right.
If there was one place I'd say where you could start to be really constructive, it's in the use of language. I really agree with Jim. I keep a pencil with me almost at all times. My students get a little annoyed by it, but I love the idea of the eraser is there on the end of the pencil because we're expected when we're engaged in learning that we're going to make mistakes. If we're not making mistakes, then we're just reviewing. We already knew it. We're not actually pushing learning. And teachers are the expert learners in our classroom. So as administrators, if we don't spend time changing the language around data, the data is frequently a punishment word.
Yeah.
It's a word that I've told Jim in the past, one of my favorite superintendents, she told me data was a four-letter word she could use on the golf course. That's not good, right? We want data to be something that's, again, it's not good or bad, but it allows for that reflection and practice. Because right now I'm working with a principal, and in her school, she's been unclear as to why she's going in and visiting different classrooms. And now that she's been collecting some of these kinds of data, when teachers come to her and say, I've been noticing this, would you please come in and observe? Both the principal has a reason why she's there and the teacher is open to that experience. That's non-evaluative, and it leads to what that eraser's for, growth. And I think that's very encouraging and begins with how we talk about data.
Yeah, so it really becomes part of the culture.
Yeah.
Okay, one last question. So when you go into a school, can you tell if they are using data in a constructive and supportive way, a hopeful way? Are there telltale signs you look for or indicators you look for?
Yeah. I like to think that when you go into a school, first of all, you can never really ask, do you have any data? That's going to send people scurrying, right? It tends to be more about asking, so how are the students doing here? And asking, how do you know? And frequently, I heard a joke. You probably can't put this in the podcast, but I heard a joke about you always know when someone's too busy because they tell you again and again and again how busy they are, right? When somebody's using data meaningfully, they actually bring it up. You don't have to ask. You don't have to wonder how data is helping make decisions because they're actually using it as part of the explanation for, we actually decided to go with this new curriculum because, and they begin to talk about student learning and teacher professional learning. And the empowerment, Jim's talked a lot about hope. Well, when teachers identify problems and schools are using data, usually that data helps justify why we're going to move in a new direction. And then everybody's on board with that. So they'll talk about it, I think.
Anything to add, Jim?
Well, that's a great insight. I think I'll just tell a little story about a teacher who used data. She video recorded two of her classes, the best class, the worst class. And when she started to analyze what was happening in the classroom, she realized it wasn't the kids that was the problem. It was that the way she was teaching was different with the two different classes. And so that's what data can do. It can help you see things you wouldn't otherwise see. Now, video helped. It was a combination of video and then looking for certain things in the classroom. But she had a objective measure of where she was in one class and where she was in the other. And once she saw the difference, then she changed what she did and the class changed. So that's, to me, the power of data is it helps you see, helps you set goals, and ultimately it helps you have an unmistakably positive impact on kids' lives.
That's a great message. Jim Knight and Michael Fajella-Luby, thanks so much for sharing your time and expertise with us. And thanks to all our listeners for tuning in. To learn more about the book, Data Rules, Elevating Teaching with Objective Reflection, go to www.ased.org/books.